Crossing the Cyber Rubicon, Stuxnet. President George W. Bush was worried about Iran. Iranian leader Mahmoud Ahmadinejad told reporters he wanted to install up to 50,000 nuclear centrifuges inside an underground facility at Natanz. These are the delicate machines needed to enrich uranium. Uranium could be used for power or weapons, but Iran had just one nuclear power plant. Nobody needed that many centrifuges just for energy. In the spring of 2006, aides debated options. Some wanted to attack Iran. Others believed the United States was already stretched thin in Iraq and Afghanistan, and any military strike would backfire, unifying Iran, prompting retaliation, and entrenching the country's desire for the bomb. Some wanted sanctions. The CIA's past sabotage efforts hadn't done much. Israel started requesting U.S. military assistance to significantly enhance its ability to strike unilaterally. It was time to get creative. General James E. Cartwright had an idea. Cartwright, who was then in charge of American nuclear deterrence, had been thinking about new technologies. What if the United States attacked Iran's centrifuges with a cyber weapon? The result was Stuxnet, the most sophisticated cyber weapon in the world, with code 50 times larger than typical malware. The CIA, the National Security Agency, and Israel's elite cyber unit 8200 reportedly joined forces. Forensics revealed that Stuxnet used four rare and valuable zero-day vulnerabilities, or coding flaws unknown to security researchers or software vendors, to find the precise software operating Iran's centrifuges, spread inside, hide, and destroy without a trace. Still, the operation needed humans. The Natanz computers were air-gapped. They weren't connected to the internet. The U.S.-Israeli team somehow got Iranians inside Natanz to infect the machines with USB drives. Apparently, only some knew they were accomplices. Stuxnet would lie in wait and then suddenly spring into action, speeding up or slowing down the spinning centrifuges for a few minutes before hiding again and repeating the operation until the centrifuges tore themselves apart. One of the officials in the operation said, "The idea was to string it out as long as possible. If you had wholesale destruction right away, it doesn't look like incompetence." All the while, Stuxnet transmitted false data showing centrifuge operations looking normal, like a fake videotape reassuring security guards standing watch that nothing was amiss. Experts believe that 1,000 of Iran's 6,000 centrifuges were destroyed, though they dispute how much of Iran's nuclear progress was delayed. A new type of weapon had been born, a cyber attack, in peacetime, that destroyed another nation's critical infrastructure. Former National Security Agency and CIA Director Michael Hayden said, "This has the whiff of August 1945, referring to the emergence of the atomic bomb. That's a big deal." Cyber attacks meant to deceive are newest on the scene. Deception, of course, has been around forever. In 480 BCE, an Athenian general named Themistocles used a double agent to lure the Persian navy into a narrow strait, where it was ambushed and defeated by a smaller fleet of more maneuverable Greek ships. During the American Revolution, George Washington's sand-filled gunpowder barrels, letters to phantom troops, and falsely positioned French bake ovens helped win the war. But cyber deception is different, operating with far greater reach, speed, sophistication, and availability. Before now, deception was an elite affair in which leaders tried to trick each other and left the rest of us out of it. Washington only needed to fool a handful of British generals to win the Revolutionary War. The Allies' surprise D-Day landing hinged on convincing Hitler and his commanders, By using phantom troops, dummy landing craft, false communications, and double agents, that Pas-de-Calais was the invasion site, not Normandy. The Soviets' 1962 nuclear gambit in Cuba required lying to President Kennedy and hiding the deployment of nuclear missiles from most Soviet military leaders, including the ship captains carrying them. Today, cyber-enabled deception operations seek to trick us all, shaping mass opinions across borders. Connective technologies, especially in democratic societies with freedom of speech, are enabling false messages to go viral at scales and speeds previously unimaginable. During the Cold War, the Soviets launched active measures campaigns to conjure false narratives that spread slowly, if at all. One suggested that the CIA was involved in the Kennedy assassination. The most well-known narrative peddled a conspiracy theory in an obscure Indian newspaper that the AIDS virus had been created by the U.S. military. It took years to gain international attention. Now, Russian disinformation is designed to flood the zone, reaching millions within hours across every format, text, video, audio, photos, and every information channel imaginable, social media, internet websites, satellite television, and traditional radio and television. Volume is key. Twitter now estimates that Russia used more than 50,000 automated accounts, or bots, to tweet election-related content during the 2016 presidential campaign. Twitter and Facebook are the best-known disinformation superhighways, but there are many others. Russian officers have infiltrated everything from 4chan to Pinterest. Overt state-funded media outlets are used to amplify false messages. In 2019, for example, RT, formerly called Russia Today, had a $300 million annual budget, video programming that looked like legitimate news in multiple languages, and more than 3 million YouTube subscribers. That's more than Fox News, CBS News, or NBC News. The aim is to overwhelm, divide, and breed distrust in information itself, undermining democratic discourse. One expert study called Russia's information warfare approach a fire hose of falsehood. Russia was the first to embrace cyber weapons of mass deception, but it's not alone anymore. China's operations grew more sophisticated during the COVID-19 pandemic, which began in Wuhan in late 2019. Within months, China's disinformation campaigns to shift blame for the virus had grown so widespread, the European Union called it an infodemic. At the same time, the U.S. National Counterintelligence and Security Center warned that foreign countries, led by Russia, but now also including China and Iran, were using online disinformation to sway U.S. voters' preferences and perspectives, to shift U.S. policies, to increase discord, and to undermine confidence in our democratic process before the 2020 presidential election. Companies are also providing spying for hire services that use false identities and wage information warfare, spreading messages with the intent of influencing what people believe, even if the information isn't true. Cygroup was one of them. Staffed by former Israeli intelligence officers, the company went defunct after its activities were revealed in The New Yorker, and reports surfaced that the company was being investigated by Special Counsel Robert Mueller as part of his 2016 election interference inquiry. Cygroup's business brochure featured a goldfish with a shark fin on its back below the tagline, "Reality is a matter of perception." The company's alleged activities included everything from creating a sham European think tank that churned out reports favoring the parliamentary election campaign of a client, to creating websites making false claims disparaging the opponent of a client running for the local hospital board in Tulare, California, a town of just 60,000 people. As one former senior Israeli intelligence official put it, social media allows you to reach virtually anyone and to play with their minds, You can be whoever you want. It's a place where wars are fought, elections are won, and terror is promoted. There are no regulations. It's a no man's land. What's more, new technologies are making cyber deception tools more effective and accessible to everyone. Manipulated photographs and video are getting better and spreading rapidly. In November 2018, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders tweeted a video that had been doctored to make it look like CNN reporter Jim Acosta was aggressively grabbing a microphone from a White House intern, when in fact he wasn't. The White House suspended Acosta's press credential, prompting outcries. A few months later, a video of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was distorted to make her sound drunk and posted on social media, where it was viewed 2 million times and made headline news. When Facebook refused to remove the fake Pelosi video, two British artists posted their own doctored video of Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg claiming he wanted to control billions of people's stolen data, all their secrets, and thanking Spectre, the fictional evil organization from James Bond stories. These cheap fakes used rudimentary technology that was relatively easy to spot. Deception is going to get much worse, thanks to advances in artificial intelligence fueling the development of deepfake digital impersonation technology. Already, deepfake technology has created remarkably lifelike photographs of non-existent celebrities, audios so real they duped an employee into letting criminals steal hundreds of thousands of dollars, and videos of leaders saying things they never uttered. Deepfakes are growing more convincing and nearly impossible to detect, thanks to a breakthrough AI technique invented by Google engineer Ian Goodfellow in 2014. Called Generative Adversarial Networks, the approach essentially pits two computer algorithms against each other. One learns to generate a realistic image of something, while the other learns to decide whether the image is real or fake. Because these algorithms are designed to learn by competing, deepfake countermeasures are unlikely to work for long. "We are outgunned," said Henry Farid, a computer science professor at the University of California at Berkeley. Deepfake code is open and spreading fast. In the past few years, anonymous GitHub users have vastly simplified the code and interface required to generate deepfakes, creating programs called FaceSwap and FakeApp, which are easy enough for a high school student with no coding background to use. The two other key ingredients for making deepfakes, computing power and large libraries of training data, are also becoming widely available. The impact of deepfakes could be profound, and policymakers know it. In 2019, deepfakes were a leading point of discussion at Congress's worldwide threat hearings, and the House Intelligence Committee held a separate hearing dedicated entirely to deepfakes for the first time. House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff said, "One does not need any great imagination to envision nightmarish scenarios that would leave the government, the media, and the public struggling to discern what is real and what is fake." Schiff proceeded to describe three possible nightmares. A malign actor creates a deepfake video of a political candidate accepting a bribe to influence an election. A hacker claims to have stolen audio of a conversation between two world leaders that never occurred. A troll farm uses text-generating algorithms to write false news stories at scale, flooding social media platforms and overwhelming journalists' ability to verify and citizens' ability to trust what they are seeing. Deception has always been part of statecraft, espionage, and warfare, but not like this. What does intelligence have to do with cyber? Four features of the evolving cyber landscape are placing unprecedented demands on intelligence. First, cyber attacks, whether they're successful or not, compromise trust in information and computer systems. In the physical world of tanks and troops, countries know immediately when they're being attacked. In cyberspace, they may not. Cyber attacks operate in the shadows, burrowing into systems to corrupt, degrade, destroy, deceive, and deny information to rightful users in hidden ways. Attackers can operate anonymously or make it look like they're somebody else. They can strike without warning or lie in wait for years. Cyberspace is an ideal battleground for secret action. That's what makes it so attractive in the first place. Iranian leaders may not have realized that their nuclear centrifuges were being destroyed by a cyber operation for months, possibly years. When North Korean rockets suddenly started exploding and veering off course in 2016, Kim Jong-un wasn't sure whether the problem was faulty engineering or a secret American cyber operation. Americans weren't sure either. A cyber operation was reportedly underway, but nobody knew for certain whether it was working. Russia's social media operation wasn't known until after the 2016 election, and understanding its full scope remains a work in progress. The SolarWinds hackers went undetected for 9 months, possibly longer. When cyber attacks take so long to uncover, uncertainty grows. Leaders start wondering, are Americans clashing because they want to exercise their First Amendment freedoms, or because they are unwitting Russian pawns undermining American democracy? Is the missile failing because of design flaws or sabotage? Are our computers working properly, or have they been compromised? Cyber operations can generate tremendous doubt about the credibility of information and whether systems are functioning as intended. Trusting computer systems to work is a big deal. Back in 1994, an obscure bug in Intel's Pentium microprocessing chip produced calculation errors in extremely rare types of high-precision division operations. Because the bug affected so few users, Intel didn't think it was a problem. Customers thought otherwise. The company ended up having to fix every chip, taking a $475 million loss. When it comes to trusting computers, even the remote possibility of an unexpected error can be too high. As my Stanford cyber colleague Herb Lin put it, if you had a calculator that gave you the wrong answer once every 10,000 times and you knew it, would you use the calculator at all or throw it away? For an adversary, generating this kind of uncertainty is one of the benefits of cyber warfare. For intelligence agencies, it's a growing problem. Remember, intelligence is the business of collecting, protecting, verifying, and understanding information for national advantage. Knowing whether citizens have been misled by foreign influence operations, or whether weapon systems have been secretly sabotaged by malware, or whether a foreign intelligence service has penetrated American spy networks, or whether information about an ally or adversary is credible. All of these questions are becoming more pervasive, more immediate, and more important for intelligence agencies to answer. Second, in cyberspace, it's hard to know when a weapon is actually a weapon. Breaches used to inflict damage are often indistinguishable from intrusions to gather intelligence. From a technical perspective, the first 90% of any cyber operation looks the same, whether the intention is defending, attacking, or just surveilling someone else's computer network. As former National Security Agency Deputy Director Chris Inglis wrote, every intrusion starts by finding and fixing a target of interest in cyberspace. It's the final 10% of any cyber weapon, the payload that gets unleashed, that determines what happens once an attacker gets inside. When spying and warfare are hard to distinguish, understanding the bigger picture becomes even more important. Policymakers need to know, is the attacker inside a network to watch, steal information, disrupt operations, delete files, corrupt them? Is the intrusion laying the groundwork for a distant future action or something imminent? When attacks can look like intelligence operations, and intelligence operations can look like attacks, the risks of miscalculation are high, and intelligence about context and adversary intentions matters more. Third, offensive cyber operations require ubiquitous, exquisite, and real-time intelligence. That's even harder than it sounds. The attack surface in cyberspace is huge, growing, and changing every millisecond. The scale and dynamism are hard to fathom. Over half the world is already connected to the internet, using more than 20 billion smart devices, including baby monitors, fitness trackers, bird feeders, medical devices, home appliances, cars, and even children's toys like Hello Barbie. The first cyber attack using a refrigerator occurred in 2013. 2 years later, Chrysler had to recall more than 1 million Jeep Cherokees after two researchers demonstrated they could remotely cut off the engine and the brakes by wirelessly accessing the car's entertainment system. In 2016, an attack using home appliances shut down the internet on much of the East Coast. In 2018, Princeton engineers showed how a botnet, or an army, of smart air conditioners and heaters could be used to launch large-scale attacks on the power grid. Technologists estimate that in every 2,500 lines of code, there's roughly one coding weakness, some kind of vulnerability that software engineers didn't anticipate or catch when they were writing it. One in 2,500 may sound reassuring. It shouldn't be. A typical Android phone runs on 12 million lines of code. Microsoft Windows has 40 million lines. That's thousands of hidden weaknesses waiting to be exploited by malign actors. Anything running on code and connected to the internet is a potential cyber attack vector. This global battle space changes every time anyone on Earth downloads an app, installs a patch, inserts a thumb drive, connects to airport Wi-Fi, or plugs in a smart toaster. Targets and vulnerabilities are all constantly appearing and disappearing. Intelligence has to keep up with these changes, finding the right vulnerabilities to exploit in the right targets at the right time, or else offensive cyber operations won't work. As the Pentagon Cyber Command put it, no target remains static, no offensive or defensive capability remains indefinitely effective, and no advantage is permanent. When tiny changes in a target can spell the difference between success and failure, intelligence is more than an input. It's an essential requirement for any mission. In the physical world, military planners can draw up target lists that last for years because things like buildings and missile silos are hard to move. Any bomb with a high enough yield will destroy a structure regardless of whether it's made of wood or concrete, whether it gets remodeled or stays exactly the same. But in cyberspace, that's not true. Cyber intelligence has to be precise and up to the minute to be useful. Getting inside a target network often requires painstaking knowledge. Even slight modifications, like installing a Microsoft update, can make a target suddenly impenetrable and a cyber bomb against it useless. What's more, intelligence about potential cyber targets has to be global to be useful. Why? Because you never know where you need to attack next. Cyber warriors need to be prepared to attack anywhere at any time. Military leaders have often lamented the terrible prediction record of where wars would occur. As Secretary of Defense Robert Gates told West Point cadets in 2011, "When it comes to predicting the nature and location of our next military engagements, since Vietnam, our record has been perfect, We have never once gotten it right, from the Mayaguez to Grenada, Panama, Somalia, the Balkans, Haiti, Kuwait, Iraq, and more. We had no idea a year before any of these missions that we would be so engaged. Before 9/11, the Clinton administration's national security priority list rated transnational terrorism and Afghanistan in the lowest tier. The military had not ordered a new map of Afghanistan in years. In the physical world, there's time to adjust. Even in crises, military mobilization takes time. Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein watched for 5 months as coalition forces gathered and developed war plans to expel him from Kuwait in 1991. Cyberspace doesn't afford that kind of time. There, preventing and responding to attacks requires mobilization in milliseconds. As Chris Inglis wrote, intelligence in cyberspace has to enable the command to go from a standing start to a precise and responsive engagement in the shortest possible time. That kind of instant response requires groundwork years in advance, everywhere. Fourth and finally, there's the quantity versus variety problem of cyber weapons. In the physical world of warfare, quantities matter. Two fighter jets are always better than one. But in cyberspace, more of the same weapon is just the same. Two copies of the same piece of malware don't get you anything more than one. In cyberspace, weapons variety wins the day, and that requires identifying different vulnerabilities and ways to exploit them. The intelligence demands are high. Silent but deadly organizational challenges. Looking ahead, meeting these demands is more than a technical challenge of zeros and ones. It's an organizational challenge involving the balance between warriors and spies, and a new understanding of who counts as a decision maker in the cyber age. To spy or not to spy has always been a question. Spies naturally prefer surveilling to attacking. Their job is acquiring information that yields advantage. Access to valuable information, whether it comes from a human or inside a computer network, is hard won and fiercely guarded. When in doubt, spies will always elect to keep listening rather than lose a collection stream. Warfighters, by contrast, want to use the information advantages they have. Their job is fighting and winning. They want to protect their soldiers in harm's way. Access to valuable information may be fleeting. If they don't use it, they could lose it. The Washington Post provided a rare glimpse into this spy versus attack dilemma when it reported on a 2008 debate involving an online forum for Islamist extremists. According to the Post, the site was actually a honeypot set up by the Saudis and the CIA to gather intelligence on potential terrorists and catch them. U.S. military leaders believed the online forum was being used by extremists to attack allied forces in Iraq. General Raymond Odierno, the top U.S. commander in Iraq, considered the threat to his forces to be so serious, he reportedly asked that the site be shut down. CIA officials believed they would lose intelligence, damage relationships with Saudi intelligence officials, and encourage extremists to migrate to other sites where they wouldn't be so easily monitored. In this case, Defense Department arguments won the day, resulting in a bizarre outcome, a U.S. military cyber operation to cripple a CIA-run website. Intelligence military frictions are especially salient in cyberspace today because intelligence is so integral to effective offensive cyber operations. It's no coincidence that the nation's top cyber warrior also runs the National Security Agency. The four-star military leader in charge of American Cyber Command has been dual-hatted ever since Cyber Command was created in 2009. This arrangement usefully consolidates cyber expertise, but tips the balance towards spying, not attacking. Cyber Command is the junior partner in this relationship. The National Security Agency has been penetrating foreign communication systems for over half a century. It has the highest concentration of the best cyber expertise in government, employing more mathematicians than any organization in the United States. As former National Security Agency Director Michael Hayden wrote, cyber weapons descend from an NSA bloodline. In 2018, two Defense Department officials wrote, "The United States needs to break through the conceptual block of looking at its own cyber capabilities primarily as instruments of foreign surveillance." Even Hayden agreed, writing that spy agencies have retarded the development of digital combat power. Cyberspace also raises new questions about who counts as a decision maker and how the intelligence community should interact with them. Before the 2016 election, the first organization to notice suspicious Russian activity on Facebook was Facebook. The company contacted U.S. law enforcement officials, but information sharing between them was rudimentary. Twitter's general counsel testified that as far as the company knew, nobody from the U.S. government told the company anything before the 2016 election about state-sponsored information operations. While intelligence about information warfare and intelligence sharing relationships have improved since then, intelligence agencies are still focused on producing classified products for Washington policymakers. Their organizational structures and cultures, career promotion incentives, analytic tradecraft, and written products are all oriented to a closed, classified world. Susan Gordon spent 40 years inside the intelligence community, including serving as the number two intelligence official from 2017 to 2019. She's convinced that intelligence must be fundamentally reformed to produce for private sector leaders and the broader public. "Our business isn't secrecy," she noted in a 2020 interview. "Our business is national security. And if the people who are affecting national security are either the populace, they're being influenced, or the private sector, they're making decisions that affect security." The intelligence community needs to inform a much broader set of decision makers. "That's not a casual change," Gordon reflected. "It's not just handing reports to new people. It requires a wholesale reimagining of how intelligence operates and who it operates for. It's also a revolutionary shift for American tech companies, many of whom resist the idea that they have any responsibility for American national security." Just as tech leaders have been stunned by hearings showing Congress's poor understanding of technology, policymakers have been stunned by Silicon Valley's cavalier view of how their products are being used by malign actors. When Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg testified before Congress in April 2018, it was a jaw-dropping moment, showing just how much naivete and profits were driving Facebook's decisions, and just how little Zuckerberg and his team had considered the possibility that anyone could use their platform to undermine democracy and inflict damage across borders. In his opening statement, Zuckerberg admitted, "Facebook is an idealistic and optimistic company. For most of our existence, we focused on all of the good that connecting people can do." Zuckerberg added, "But it's clear now that we didn't do enough to prevent these tools from being used for harm." While Facebook executives have been apologizing to Congress in public, they have been waging a campaign in private to deny, delay, and deflect regulation and stifle critics. Google executives, citing ethical concerns, canceled an artificial intelligence project with the Pentagon and refused to even bid on the Defense Department's Project JEDI, a desperately needed $10 billion program to modernize the military's cloud computing systems. At the same time, Google agreed to help the Chinese government develop a more effective censored search engine until outcries from human rights groups, American politicians, and its own employees became overwhelming. In 2019 congressional hearings, Google's vice president of public policy would not commit the company to refusing Chinese business that involved censoring information to Chinese citizens. Many in tech companies harbor deep ethical concerns about helping warfighters, while many in the defense community harbor deep ethical concerns about what they view as the erosion of patriotism and national service in the tech industry. Each side is left wondering, how can anyone possibly think that way? In 2018, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph Dunford, was asked what he would tell engineers at companies like Google and Amazon. Dunford replied, "Hey, we're the good guys. It's inexplicable to me that we wouldn't have a cooperative relationship with the private sector." It's hard to overstate just how foreign the worlds of Washington and Silicon Valley are to each other. At the exact moment when great power conflict is making a comeback and harnessing technology is the key to success, Silicon Valley and Washington are still working on working together. Closing this divide is nothing short of a national security imperative. Intelligence has never been more important or challenging. Cyber threats are vastly different from traditional national security threats, with profound implications for intelligence. In cyberspace, everyone is vulnerable. Adversaries steal, spy, disrupt, destroy, and deceive at speeds and scales unthinkable even a few years ago. Uncertainty abounds. Espionage, defense, and attack are hard to differentiate. Cyber weapons require global, persistent, real-time intelligence to work. It's a tall order. And that's not all. Increasingly, key cyber decision-makers sit in boardrooms and living rooms, not just in the White House Situation Room. Cyber threats directly involve technology companies and everyday citizens, whether they like it or not. In this emerging world, intelligence has never been more important or more challenging. Acknowledgements. I began studying intelligence by accident. I had just finished a summer stint working on Asia policy on President Clinton's National Security Council staff and had returned to Stanford to start my political science doctoral dissertation. It was 1993. The Cold War was over, and the talk was of peace dividends, the inexorable spread of democracy, and the end of history. But as I searched for a topic, I saw uncertainty, not closure. I kept thinking about what I had experienced on the National Security Council staff, decision makers grappling with how to understand the end of one era and the unknowns of another. I became fascinated by information and institutions and how the machinery of government made sense of the world beyond. Camping out in the darkened basement of Green Library, I began poring through government documents about the institutions created at the dawn of the Cold War. I soon discovered the National Security Act of 1947, which reorganized the military, created the National Security Council, and established an organization that received almost no attention in the bitter congressional debates of the time, the Central Intelligence Agency. I've been hooked on intelligence ever since. This book draws on nearly 30 years of research about the evolution, operation, and challenges of American intelligence agencies, as well as my personal experiences advising policymakers, interviewing intelligence officers, and teaching undergraduates about this secret world at UCLA and Stanford. Authors often say there are too many people to thank properly. With a book so long in the making, this time it's really true. I owe an enduring debt to all of the intelligence officers and policymakers who have generously shared their thoughts in personal interviews over many years. Although several are attributed by name, most have asked to remain anonymous. A talented crew of undergraduate and graduate student research assistants contributed invaluably to this project. I am particularly indebted to Sebastian Alarcon, Philip Clark, Matt Clausen, Gabby Conforti, Alexa Course, Ravi Doshi, Stacy Edgar, Kyle Fendorf, Matt Ferraro, Katie Frost, Cole Griffiths, Taylor Grossman, Rachel Hirschman, Catherine Arajpana, Dylan Junkin, Catherine Lead, Ryan Likes, Melinda McVeigh, Greg Majette, Andrew Millick, Eric Min, Josh Mukhopadhyay, Avanika Narayan, Jacqueline Nelson, Avery Rogers, Jean Schindler, Tian Vo, Margaret Fairtree Williams, Antigone Xenopoulos, Chris Yeh, and Corinne Zanoli. I am deeply grateful for the vibrant and generous intellectual community at Stanford University's Center for International Security and Cooperation, or CSAC, the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies, or FSI, the Hoover Institution, the Institute for Human-Centered Artificial Intelligence, or HAI, and the Department of Political Science. For their leadership and partnership, I'd especially like to thank Rod Ewing, Colin Call, and Harold Trinkunas at CSAC, Michael McFall and Catherine Stoner at FSI, Condi Rice and Dan Kessler at Hoover, Feifei Li, John Etchemendi, and Michael Salito at HAI, and Political Science Chair Mike Toms. Bob and Marian Oster, Lou and Pilar Davies, Rod and Lori Shepard, and Shirley Cox Madison and her late husband Duncan have been unwavering champions of Hoover's National Security Affairs Fellows Program and our national security endeavors. I am honored beyond words to be the Morris Arnold and Nona Jean Cox Senior Fellow at Hoover, and to have the name of Shirley's parents next to my own. I would also like to thank the Hoover and FSI staff who make everything possible, especially Carmen Allison, Christina Ansel, Chris Dower, Kelly Doran, Andrea Gray, Stephanie James, Rick Jara, Karen Weiss-Mulder, Nami Nguyen, Emily Silva, Jules Porter-Thompson, and Shannon York. I have benefited tremendously from the research, seminars, discussions, questions, advice, and assistance of Michael Allen, Elizabeth Allison, Matt Atkins, Jim Baker, Nora Bensahel, Tom Burson, Chip Blacker, Brad Boyd, David Brady, Michael Brown, Robert Cardillo, Al Carnazale, Bobby Chesney, Kevin Childs, Matt Cordova, Martha Crenshaw, Mariano Florentino Cuellar, Matt Daniels, Eric DeMarco, Larry Diamond, Whit Diffie, Dan Dresner, Kristen Eikenser, Neil Ferguson, Jack Goldsmith, Andy Grotto, Rosanna Guadagno, Anna Jamawabusa, Jim Fearon, Joe Felter, Frank Fukuyama, Steve Haber, Leon Hall, Jeff Hancock, Marty Hellman, Tomas Ilves, Chris Inglis, Bobby Inman, Jameel Jaffer, Bob Jervis, Locke Johnson, David Kennedy, Michael Kaczynski, Steve Krasner, Paul Kratiger, Sarah Kreps, Todd Mahar, Matteo Martimucci, Mark Mazzetti, H.R. McMaster, Greg Mendenhall, Karen Yari Milo, Esfandiar Mir, Barry Papa Murphy, Dutch Murray, Paul Narain, Ann Neuberger, the late and great Jan Nolan, Joe Nye, Martine Opus, Enrique Oti, Bill Perry, Mark Zulu Pai, Julie Quinn, Jay Raymond, Eric Reed, Mike Robinson, Lee Ross, Gary Roughhead, David Sanger, Maricha Shake, Jackie Schneider, Adam Siegel, Raj Shaw, Scott Shane, the late George Schultz, Jennifer Smith Hayes, Abe Sofair, Alex Stamos, Eli Sugarman, John Taylor, Phil Taubman, Phil Tetlock, John Villasenor, and Janine Zakaria. Other institutions hosted initiatives and discussions that helped improve particular chapters and ideas. thanks to my fellow commissioners on the CSIS Technology and Intelligence Task Force and the leaders of our band, Avril Haines, Stephanie O'Sullivan, Kath Hicks, and Brian Katz. The American Academy of Arts and Sciences Project on Meeting the Challenges of the New Nuclear Age, led by Vipin Narang and Scott Sagan, took me into the fascinating world of open-source nuclear threat intelligence and brought scary workshops on all things nuclear to my desktop during the pandemic. The Atlantic asked me to write about my research for a broader audience, and I could not have done it without the support and editorial magic of Kathy Gilsonen, Dante Ramos, and Yoni Applebaum. My deep thanks also to the Strauss Center at the University of Texas at Austin and Harvard's Belfer Center for giving me opportunities to discuss all things cyber. A virtual murder board of experts read early chapters and offered priceless feedback. Stephen Aftergood, Tom Finger, Joe Garten, Rose Gottemuller, Sig Hecker, Rick Leggett, John McLaughlin, Frank Pabian, Allison Puccioni, Josh Rovner, Steve Slick, Michael Sulmeyer, Jeff Vanek, and Matt Waxman. A special thanks to Herb Lin and Michael Morell, dream co-authors, whose collaborations on technology, cyber challenges, and intelligence sharpened my thinking and got this ball rolling. My talented literary agent, Christy Fletcher, has been giving me great guidance for over a decade. Chuck Myers, Eric Crahan, Bridget Flannery McCoy, and their wonderful team at Princeton University Press showed far more patience than I deserve, sticking with this project and improving it every step of the way. Thanks also to Jane Franson, who helped make my prose sing. This book would never have been written without the keen minds, kind hearts, and dedication of my research director, Taylor Johnson McLamb, and my former chief of staff and research associate, Russell Wald. Condi Rice started me on this journey in graduate school. The only experience more rewarding than having her as a doctoral advisor is coming back to Stanford and working with her as a dear colleague. My thanks to the extended Mallory and Ziegert clans, two incredible families. The COVID-19 pandemic brought unexpected lockdown with my kids, Alexander, Jack, and Kate Mallory. Experiencing daily life in close quarters with two displaced college students and a teen daughter has been a rare gift. From our serious national security dinner conversations to the daily ribbing about my office wall notes looking like Carrie Matheson in her craziest moments. Each brought different rays of sunshine to a dark time and made this book immeasurably better. Alexander gave me new insight into computer science and how engineers think. Jack read and offered feedback on every chapter. Kate helped me test drive ideas in her high school foreign policy class. Nothing says love more than letting your embarrassing mother teach your 16-year-old friends. My husband, Craig Mallory, brought his writer's flair and lawyerly mind to every page and made me think hard and laugh harder. Six moves, six books, five careers, three kids, and seven high-maintenance pets later, the evidence is in. I won the lottery when I met him. This has been a Kalorama production, read by Amy B. Ziegert. Copyright 2022 by Amy B. Ziegert. Published by arrangement with Amy B. Ziegert, care of Fletcher and Company. Recording copyright 2022 by Kalorama, an imprint of Recorded Books, Highbridge.